I got a plan. Lily, I'm gonna need the spare key to Robin's apartment.
I see where this is going. Ted, waiting naked in a girl's bed wearing whipped cream undies does not work. Usually. The setting, Martha's Vineyard, 1999.
I just wanted to let you know about my study group.
Oh, don't be a fuddy-duddy. I'll be your study buddy.
I'm about to embark on one of the great challenges of my scientific career.
This work right here is gonna change history.
I think this is gonna be our greatest mission.
I don't have time to study!
I got big plans for you tonight. I got maps, I got charts. I gotta see you through this because my credibility is on the line.
It's at this point that you'll want to start taking notes.
Welcome to the Sitcom Study, the podcast where we contemplate the TV shows we grew up with and search for the truth and wisdom within the tropes and cliches. And Amy, what are we talking about?
Well, this is our 52nd episode, and there are 52 weeks in a year, and that means we've been on the air for 1 year, and this is our season finale. So we're talking about season finales.
Season one finales. Yeah, you said it, a full year of the Sitcom Study. We have been podcasting every week for 52 weeks. Now, look, I, as a, you know, podcast listener, I don't really think in terms of seasons. Most of the podcasts I listen to are just ongoing things, and that's kind of what this is. But we did realize at some point, wow, we're going to have made it a year without ever taking a week off, and we decided to declare that, like you said, our season finale. So what that means is we're going to take a few weeks off from making new podcasts. We've got some fun ideas up our sleeve for ways to keep the podcast feed active, but for just a few weeks, we're going to take a break from producing new full episodes. Now, if you like the show and have enjoyed the past year of listening to the Sitcom Study, I'll reiterate what we say at the end of every podcast, what every podcast says. The most helpful thing you can do for the show is to rate it or review it on whatever podcast app you're listening to right now. It really is the best way to help us, you know, grow the show, reach new people without having to spend money on ads and everything. It is a mitzvah. The other thing that you can do is get in touch with us. Send us an email at sitcomstudypodcast@gmail.com or find us on Instagram. We are in the market for tropes. We want new tropes for the new year. We thank everybody who has gotten in touch so far with all the sitcom trope ideas. If we haven't done it yet, it doesn't mean we're not going to. And so by all means, we want to know your ideas. We want to know your thoughts on everything we've covered. Do you like it when we go back to the olden days with Andy Griffith? Would you rather we stay with the new stuff? All kinds of stuff like that. We're very much in the market for your thoughts. And so, yeah, today we're going to touch on a handful of season one finales. I think we've got one from each decade, maybe from the 80s to the 2010s, or maybe MASH dips back into the 70s.
Yeah, but MASH is in the 70s, and then we've got 90s, 2000s, and 2010s today, and they are all podcast newbies.
Yeah. And so, yeah, we're going to talk about all of those and maybe reflect a little bit on everything we've covered over the last year. If we have any thoughts about the, you know, 52 times four episodes of sitcoms that we've watched, plus all of those two-parters and everything. So, yeah, lots to talk about. What is our lineup for today?
So I can't believe we got all the way to the end of season one of the Sitcom Study without talking about MASH, Living Single, How I Met Your Mother, and Brooklyn Nine-Nine. We will be covering the season one finales of all four of those shows, and they're all in the 20s. They're all like 24, 27, 22 as episode numbers.
Yeah, so starting with MASH, this is a big one, obviously. This is mostly before our time. It was hanging around still when we were kids. I remember the final episode of MASH being a huge deal.
It was in like 1983, 1984, something like that. at that. There were 11 seasons of MASH. Yeah. The joke about MASH is that it was all about a 3-year conflict, and there were 250 some episodes, and it lasted for 11 years.
Yes, this is the military version of the kids that stay in high school for 7 years.
Right.
So what was your experience with this? Did you watch it in reruns?
No, I have not seen very much of MASH. I don't know a lot about it. My parents, I think, maybe watched it, but they definitely watched it like when I was younger and or before I was watching television, like before I came along. This was not one that was it's one of these things that like people have always referenced, but I don't get a lot of the references because I haven't seen a lot of it.
Yeah, MASH was definitely available to us. I remember it being on in reruns. And I didn't like it for the same reason I didn't like Westerns. It was too dusty. You know, if you asked me what the problem was, I would just say, you just look at it. And sure enough, watching it now, I feel like if you're watching an episode of MASH at any given time, about 70% of the pixels on your screen are going to be olive green or brown.
Yeah, like khaki.
Show is dirt and army fatigues and then a little bit of sky at the top to give you like a little bit of blue. But yeah, it just has that very distinctive look. And when I was younger, it was a turnoff. Now I find it very interesting. We can get into the whole sort of kind of anachronistic single camera style of this, but it definitely, it doesn't look like any other sitcom. It looks like a movie about a military base.
Well, and it was, right? So it was, this is another one of these movies turned sitcoms, which is a trope that's on the list that we will definitely cover at some point.
Well, yeah, I have never seen the Robert Altman MASH movie, which is a little bit of a blind spot for me as a movie enthusiast. And yeah, we definitely do plan to do a, you know, movies turned sitcoms episode where we can watch the pilot of this and really dig into how it translates over. I know Elliot Gould plays the Alan Alda character in the movie, which I find very interesting. Elliot Gould was a huge star in the 70s, and he was this big counterculture movie icon. And so, you know, at that time, Alan Alda would be the TV version, and he was nothing before this or wasn't as popular. I will say now, with the benefit of hindsight, give me Alan Alda any day of the week. This guy is sexy as hell. He comes across as smart. He just has this, like, he really captures you. I think he's one of the great sitcom leading men ever. You know, we talk about that spectrum of like the nerdy nebbishy guys to the sort of more classical leading man. Yeah. He is a perfect in between. Yeah, he's got
he
that
is
unique.
Tom Hanks, like.
But he's not, because he's Alan Alda. Like Tom Hanks, he is his own thing.
He's that perfect line of, you know, like the smart and comedy and caring. And like he does a great job with it. I didn't realize that Alan Alda was so attractive when he was younger. So we get to the end of the episode and I turned to Jay and I was like, man, Alan Alda's kind of cute. You know, I didn't realize he was so handsome. And Jay leans over, shows me his notes, and it says, Alan Alda equals hot AF.
Yes. Yes, that is the third thing I wrote down. Alda is hot as all get out. This episode is framed even more cinematically, I feel like, than a typical episode of MASH, which is already quite cinematic. This is a single camera, shot on film type of show. And this one especially has this sort of arty, you know, meandering framework to it, where it's centered around this concert. So it begins.
Yeah, it's like a USO show that has come to town, that has come to the base, you know, their camp, and they're performing. And that serves as like the little slice of life of living within their camp.
Because what we're going to get, is initially those ladies, these three ladies, like the
Miller
Dixie sisters,
is what
Miller
they're called.
Sisters singing. And then it shows you in the crowd, Alda, smoldering as usual, with his little folded up paperback book. And you see him just like staring dead faced and looking into his little paperback book. And it's just like, I think it's supposed to be like we're at this concert and he's got this moment of peace to relax with his little book. And it's like he's just kind of sitting there staring off into space. And all these little vignettes that we're going to get throughout the episode, little moments in surgery and little other human moments and whatnot, I think are supposed to be like these little episodes, if you will, that are floating through his mind as he watches this concert.
Right. It's like a day in the life of, you know, someone living in the camp in that like their camp, but also like Jay's saying, it's intercut with this USO show. So we're getting all these different moments in time. And so because we're not as familiar with the characters from MASH, had to do a little bit of research to understand why these are the moments that Hawkeye might be thinking of. And so one of the main through lines of this show, of this episode, all these little mini episodes of Major Frank Burns, who's one of the doctors, he and Hawkeye don't really get along. And so Hawkeye's always playing tricks on him, trying to get him to lighten up, right? In this episode, it's flipped. And so Burns is playing all these tricks on Hawkeye and getting him. Usually Hawkeye's the one that, like, you know, gets him in the end and is always able to, like, be smarter and outwit the guy. Well, he just, in these episodes, he just keeps getting tricked all the way until the end, and then he gets his revenge.
Jim and Dwight of the mobile hospital.
That's basically what they're like. And so we get all these funny little scenes where, like, Major Burns has, he switched the plumbing around in the showers. So when Alan Alda's Hawkeye goes into the showers and he's standing in one of the showers and he pulls the chain, no water comes out of that shower head. It comes out of the one next to it. So something with like plumbing and like, you know, those step activated panels or something is going on. And so then he changes to the other shower stall and pulls on that chain. And then the other one comes on and he checks them. And then it's only when he's standing in there that they, anyway, so that's all funny.
Classic
he can't take
bit.
A shower. And then there's another one where he like, Major Burns runs a tripwire across the entrance to some, you know, tent or whatever. And Hawkeye walks in and a bucket of water dumps on his head. So it's like, he's just like, all right, I'm getting my comeuppance. Okay. Never says a word. And then Major Burns is like cackling with laughter.
Yeah. Well, there's a line in one of these surgery scenes, and I don't know if this is the character Burns that you're talking about. It's one of the non-Alan Alda characters who's doing the surgery, and he makes a joke, and the nurse or somebody says, like, you know, how can you make jokes during surgery or something like
that? That's Trapper John. Okay. And that's a separate storyline. So Hot Lips and Trapper John, their storyline through this whole thing is they are trying to save a patient, and it's really dire. Like, they don't think that the guy's going to make it. And so we have this really intense surgery scenes that we keep cutting back to multiple times of him trying to save this guy and her being there, the head nurse.
Yeah, and she asks him, you know, why are you making jokes or whatever? She says, you know, do you think it's appropriate to make jokes at a time like this? And he says, making jokes are necessary at a time like this. And I feel like that's sort of the ethos
of
MASH
in
a nutshell. You know, the theme sequence for this is all like people on stretchers and gurneys and stuff, like bodies being dumped into the morgue and stuff. So, yeah, you just get the sense of, like, you know, obvious. It almost just seems like a gimmick nowadays, but you have to kind of turn back the clock and realize, like, nothing like this would have ever been done, especially on TV, where it just, that is this, the whole thing is, like, can you make a sitcom, like, the dopiest form of all comedy in this setting,
right?
You know, this is, it takes place
it's
during.
It's not like an ER or a St. Elsewhere or any of these medical dramas that have existed. This has the elements of the medical drama, but it's also a comedy. It's very much like a situation comedy.
Yes, which does bring us, I think, to the one overall note I would have about the way this show was put together. Same thing we talked about with Square Pegs, right? It's that fake laugh track that is put in there just like, because it's the 70s and 80s and it's a sitcom and we haven't quite figured out yet that not all sitcoms need this. And to me, this is the most jarring of anything. I feel like if this, the Flintstones, the live audience makes more sense than it does on this, because it's like I said before, it's shot single camera style. There are all these, you know, there's over the shoulder shots during dialogue scenes. There's this whole USO conference is filmed from the point of view of audience members with the camera, you know, within the crowd. Wow, like all of these things that are great. They make it cinematic, but they also make it just fundamentally impossible to conceive of this being shot like a sitcom in front of an audience like that. And so it is just so strange. And the fact that so much of it is serious. So like Square Pegs, you kind of like the fake studio audience sort of goes away for like 10 minutes at a time and will then come
back.
Yeah,
and I don't remember even noticing it in this. Like, I think it just blew right by me in the way that a lot of times it does in these old-timey shows that I don't notice. I definitely noticed it in Square Pegs, though. But I don't remember noticing it. So I'm glad that you reminded me of it. But so the way the whole Hawkeye and Major Burns thing gets kicked off is that they are coming out of Jeeps having just picked all the medical evacuees up off of the chopper, and they're unloading them into the hospital and pointing them in the direction of the different operating tents. And Burns says, you know, this one needs a quarter of a grain of morphine. And Hawkeye is like, no, he needs a third of a grain. Did you see the size of that guy? And he's been, you know, bumping around in a chopper for an hour and a half with a, you know, his leg half blown off. Like, he needs to have a little bit more morphine. And so they are arguing about it. And Major Burns is like, do you see this oak leaf on my collar? Do you know what that means? And he's like, yeah, I don't care. I went to med school, like, listen to me, kind of a thing. And so they have this little pissing contest. And it's in public, you know, where the nurses and the orderlies are like around taking orders from one or the other of them. And Alda wins the day. And so that's why Burns is like, all right, well, I'm going to get you, and starts doing all of these pranks.
Yeah. Now, there's another through line in the episode, which is religion, right? There's this character.
Father Mulcahy has a crisis of faith.
Right. And meanwhile, Alan Alda is almost like, you get the impression he's the secular guy who's kind of like, I think God's probably real. You know, like they're having this conversation, and it's one of these quiet, pensive moments. And as they're pondering religion, Hawkeye says, I'm able to do things in surgery that I don't think I'm good enough to do. You know, and so he's basically saying, like, what's happening around us. And look, people, I think, who have been to war in real life might tell you that that is definitely evidence that there is no God. But he's saying, like, yeah, look, the things that I'm able to do sometimes are miraculous.
Yeah, I was not trained to do that, and I do not have the capacity to do that, but I do it. And so that has to come from somewhere. And so that's the other thing that has this whole episode. Everyone is sort of, it's like almost like opposite day.
Yeah.
While this is going on, the reason that he's thinking over this day is that everything was a little bit different than usual. Like, he, you know, Hawkeye has this moment where he's very serious and like reassuring the priest that there is a God and that his work is meaningful, when usually it's the other way around. It's that Hawkeye's having a crisis, you know, like upset or something. And it's the father who's the one that's like, look, a little pearl of wisdom from my years of consoling people and counseling people. And so this time it was the other way around. Similarly, we've got the switcheroo with the jokes. The pranks are being played by the guy who's normally getting pranked. And then, yeah, and so same kind of a thing. And then there's a parallel of that with the third story, which is Radar and Lieutenant Colonel Blake. This is season one, so we don't have what's his name, Houlihan, that we get later in the later seasons. This is Lieutenant Colonel Henry Blake, and he is the, you know, in charge of the whole base, and he is having a baby. His wife is giving birth, and so Radar is like manning the radar and the phones, the communication system, to hear when his wife is going to give birth to, we find out later, it's a son. And so that is like this, you know, they're usually up in everybody's business and being really annoying and like creating conflict in places because they're getting involved in things, and they're not this time because they're just sort of locked into trying to find out about his wife.
Yeah, but that's also another kind of opposite.
Yeah,
it's a birth happening at the same time as this death, or is this, do they end up saving the patient or does he die?
They do save the patient, okay. And it's one of those moments where it restores the father's faith. Because he comes over, Father Mulcahy, he comes over, and they're like, you know, he's probably not going to make it. We don't think he's going to wake up. And then as Father Mulcahy touches his hands, he stirs and like starts to look around.
Yeah. So you've got that situation, even though they do ultimately save the guy, you've got, you know, they're surrounded by death, and then you have the birth, you know, and so you have this sort of like spiritual, like a little bit of everything at the same time as they're contemplating religion. I really like Radar, you know, as a relative newbie to MASH. He is my favorite, you know. He's like a little George Costanza. I like his style. I like his energy. And yeah, those scenes are fun with the two of them. You know, he's on the phone and everything. I notice in all these surgery scenes, like the mise en scène, if you will, of this show, you know, like we said, it's certainly not like a typical sitcom with being all goofy and loud and crazy and everything, but it's not really like any war movie or medical movie you've ever seen either. Like, I noticed there's never any music.
No, in these, I mean, except for the opening and closing. Scenes.
Right,
yeah.
Right, little transitional things, but there's never any music. It's very, very quiet.
Right.
And, you know, the camera work is, again, more than you would have in a typical multicam sitcom, but it's still a TV show.
A really good job at making it feel crowded in the, it feels like it's in close quarters in the surgery scenes. Like they are, you know, kind of shooting from down at the gurney level up to where the doctors are and kind of crouched in close. And it feels very much like, because of the angle and you can see the tent ceiling like right on top of them, it feels very small.
Yeah. What I would say it doesn't feel is urgent, for better or worse. And it might be that these medical things, you know, maybe they weren't like that. But I just notice in general, not just in the surgery stuff, the vibe of the show is quiet. You know, like it has this quiet sort of mellow feel to it. And, you know, they are in the hospital camp or whatever. It's not like they're in the front lines of the war, but it still struck me as strange, you know, and I didn't know to what extent that was intentional.
Interesting, because I was feeling the drama of it because they weren't trying to over lean into it.
Yeah.
In the same way that, like, when bad things happen to me and in my life, I get very focused and like serious, and we buckle down and we get it done, and it's like, here we go, right? I felt that because these scenes were so quiet and small, and, you know, they would take a close up of the sweat on his brow.
Yeah.
And then the Ugly John character would be like, I don't know if he's going to make it, but he wouldn't say it in this, I don't know if he's going to make it, like they would now, where they're trying to like amp up the drama. He's just like, so I don't think he's going to make it. You've only got about another 2 minutes. I think you should probably sew him up now. Like, it's all very matter of fact. Which, by the way, if I'm ever in surgery, I hope that's how the doctors actually are. Because it felt like the seriousness of the situation was the seriousness of the situation. It didn't feel over-dramatized and like overwrought in a way that like people are just making it about themselves. Like, you only have another minute to sew him up. Like, that's about you. That's not helping the situation by yelling.
Yeah. But I did think in general, yeah, the vibe of mesh of this mobile, you know, hospital unit or whatever is it's like a Buddhist monastery or something. Like, it just has this very quiet,
go that far. You know, I mean, like, they're still cutting up and making jokes. And
yeah,
we didn't get any, what's his name, Klinger in this episode, but you know, he's running around in heels and his shenanigans usually.
Yeah, we do get what I assume was a one-off character, Woody Allen, basically, right? Like this guy
who is very much a
Woody Allen knockoff.
He's like, I can't wait till I go back to New York, you know? Yeah,
but just the guy, the look, the way of talking, it just, it very much put this episode or this show in that late 70s time, yeah. You know, when
he's
he
a New York dentist,
yeah.
And he just couldn't wait. And he was so like worried about every little thing. Like he was like, oh, I'm going to get a paper cut if I touch this.
Yeah,
you know
well,
what
he's
I mean?
Got his dismissal like, orders.
Right.
Like, he's
that's why
to
he didn't
home.
Want to touch anything. Because...
But I didn't understand it because he's like, I'm afraid of getting hurt or injured at the last minute. But
right.
If you get injured, don't you get to go home anyway?
No, he would have to stay there until he could heal. And then they would put him on the transport. Right. So that's what ended up happening. He was so worried. Just like you hear about like, oh, man, she waited an extra 5 years to retire. And then the day she retired, she got diagnosed with cancer or something. It's like horrible. But so this is what he's worried is going to happen. And he is like, he won't touch anything. Somebody was like, hey, pass me the salt. And he was like, nope, I'm not touching anything. It might be a trap. Like, he's just absolutely not. He's got a paper. His dismissal orders are in his pocket. And he tells Hawkeye, you can take it out of my pocket. I'm not touching it. I'm not handing it to you. And then he goes to get into the Jeep to leave, to go to his airplane, to go back to his family and leave Korea. And as he moves the driver out of the way and is like, nope, I'm not trusting anyone. And drives away and immediately crashes and ends up in traction and can't fly home.
Yeah, so that's his deal. The only other real thing, like plot-wise, that I made note of is with the baby story, Lieutenant Blake can't meet his baby in person because he's stationed at MASH. So Radar brings in a random Korean child.
Right. So Lieutenant Colonel Blake is all sad that he's had this kid that he is like, well, I, you know, not going to get to meet him. You know, hopefully I'll get out of here in time for him to come and, you know, before he gets drafted and sent over here. And so he's sad that he's not there at the birth of his child. And he, so Radar arranges for this, one of these women who works in their laundry. She's a Korean woman and she has just had a child. So she brings her baby over so Lieutenant Colonel Blake can hold him. But the sad story is Lieutenant Colonel Blake, the character, leaves the show in like season 4 or whatever. And the way he's written off the show is that he dies in his transport home. So he was shot down. So he never did actually get to meet that son.
Yeah. What the hell? Why did they have to do it like that?
It's really sad. They also never mentioned that son again after this episode.
All right. Well,
so
yeah, I mean, like we said, the episode is intentionally sort of formless and artsy. You do have the moment later on, like you mentioned, where, you know, when it seems like the patient is a goner, the priest character leans down next to him, and that seems to be what brings him back from the brink of death. We have an amazing case of a actor's hidden talents when Radar takes to the drums at the USO show and does this crazy drum solo for like 4 minutes.
So Radar was the original Charlie Brown in the off-Broadway, very first off-Broadway production of...
Literally the part he was born to play. That is perfect.
Yep, casting. There you go. And he is also a jazz drummer. He was in some band. He was like the drummer for some, you know, jazz trio for years and years and years. Lots of professional drumming experience. And that drum kit is his hero, Gene Krupa's. actual drum kit.
Yeah, so I mean, look, we get all that pondering and everything, and the end of the episode is the MC of the show sort of giving a little sign-off spiel, and it's one of those, they kind of tie it in, so it's sort of like he's talking to us, the audience, on behalf of MASH, the TV show.
Right.
It's one of those like, all right, folks, you know, we've had some laughs, but now it's time to go.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, and they thought that this might be the last episode of the show, because this was a very low-rated show in its first season, and in order to drum up the ratings over the summertime, they ran two reruns a week rather than just the one to start to gain interest in the show. And it worked. And second season and beyond, it was other than I think like one season, they dropped to number 15. They were always in the top 10 after that.
So, yeah, you know, I mean, like I said, the stories kind of come and go. I think this was cool for, you know, what it did with the season finale occasion was, just like we're saying, it took the opportunity to play with the form a little bit.
Yeah.
And do like, okay, this isn't going to be like, oh, here's one. Like, they could have gone, oh, Lieutenant Colonel Blake has a baby. That's a special moment. That'll be the last episode.
Right.
But instead, they make it this weird thing that doesn't have this one story or an ABC story.
Yeah.
And the fact that notion of the USO concert is just this kind of clever way to tie it all together.
And the fact that everybody is different from what they normally are.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like this, you know, you thought you'd gotten to know us, and you do, you know, over the course of the season, you have gotten to know us, but we're all multifaceted, and here are some examples of these times that we're actually showing a different side of the personality than you normally get to see. So I think for all of those reasons, and this is kind of, I mean, this is 1973. We're not really in the land yet of season finales being this big thing.
No, that's exactly what I was gonna say, is that the further back you go, the less of a big deal it is. And, you know, we found that out by trying to pick the shows for this podcast. You know, when you go back to the 80s and earlier, a lot of times the season finale is just the show that they aired last.
Right.
And there isn't much of a thing to it. And now anything that comes out, the season is crafted, even something that's kind of episodic and silly, they're going to make sure there's some sort of overarching narrative that's going to reach its climax in the season finale. So yeah, the fact that they make this special, I think, is impressive,
right?
You know, all the more. Okay, let's move on to Living Single.
Season 1, episode 27, What's Next?
Yeah, so this starts in 1993. So I would have been 14. A new show about a bunch of single ladies and their dating foibles, I don't think would really have been my cup of tea. So this went right under my radar. I had very little awareness or interest in this at the time. What was your relationship with this?
So this was one of those shows on Fox that was just as I was being allowed to start watching it. Right. So we had the shows earlier on that was like hard no, you know, that little cartoon boy says, eat my shorts. You're not watching
out
it.
On Herman's Head.
That's right. Another Herman's Head. My parents were not into me watching Married with Children at all. But this one, fine. Like this one was, I was already starting to dip my toe into In Living Color, you know, so I was getting into the sketch comedy because they knew how much I loved SNL. From around 10 years old, I would stay up after they went to bed and like sneak out of my room and go into the spare room to watch SNL. And so they knew that I loved SNL, so they let me watch In Living Color, and then that kind of was like the gateway drug.
In Living Color is the gateway to Living Single.
Well, to Fox. That was the gateway drug to being allowed to watch Fox. So when Living Single came out, I remember this first season. I watched this first season, and then Friends came on.
Mm.
And I moved over as the white girl that I am to Friends.
Well, look, Friends was a cultural juggernaut. It's interesting to know that this beat Friends to the punch. And that was something that was very clear to me watching it. You know, I also watched the first few episodes this afternoon just to get a sense of it. And I didn't know exactly when it came out in relation to Friends, but it's clear that the show, even though it's pretty good and can definitely be funny, that Seinfeld and Friends revolution in the 90s of the sitcom writing hadn't quite happened yet, and it still is a little bit in that 80s, early 90s mold. You know, it just, I don't know, there's just something about Friends that did have a zhuzh to it.
I think you're talking about Jimmy Burrows. I think you're talking about the, you know, just the cred of the creative team behind it and the direction, you know, like the director. This show, so this woman, Yvette Denise Lee, she had done Hanging with Mr. Cooper, and I think she had done some stuff on Different World as well. So she was a writer already, and this was like her chance to be the showrunner. So, you know, she's creating this world, and Queen Latifah has told a story in subsequent years about how this NBC executive comes to some like rap party or some like, you know, thing where all the networky people are, and Living Single's this big hit and is being celebrated. And he says to one of the Fox guys, you know, if I could take one show, it would be Living Single. And then the very next season, Friends came out. Mm-hmm. So it is like direct, like it happened because of Living Single.
So it's about these four ladies. And I feel like the first among equals is Queen Latifah, right? She's Khadija. A lot of the show takes place at their publishing office.
Well, Khadija works for a like an ebony kind of magazine. That's what she works for. And then Max is a high-powered attorney. And then you've got Kim Coles, who is like an assistant at the magazine as well. And I don't know what Tootie's character does. The girl, Kim Fields, who plays Tootie from Facts of Life, she was like the big, you know, she and Queen Latifah were the big names in this show. You had like sitcom royalty, and then you had rap royalty coming together to be the leads in this show. And then that you've got their other two, the two neighbors, the two guys that are like Joey and Chandler, who live across the hall, right? And they live, so they live in a brownstone in Brooklyn, and the girls have like the big apartment that is multiple floors, and the guys just have like a tiny apartment that's kind of across, like in the same building across the hall. And so that's, what is it? Overton and Kyle are the two guys that live across the hall.
Yes. So at the start of this episode, I definitely thought that they were a gay couple, and what? I was applauding this show for having an amazingly, you know, enlightened portrayal of
them. Why?
Because the first we see of them in this episode is they're bickering about something in their apartment.
Right. Like so something Overton about finds this nasty leather chair on the side of the road, and he's trying to drag it in and is like, oh, I'm going to redo this chair and put in vibrations and speakers.
Two grown men that live together, and they're fighting about some decoration for their apartment. It didn't even occur to me that they weren't a couple
until later when Kyle sleeps with Max.
Yeah, and so I was like, this is great, 1993 Fox show, and we're getting these guys acting normal and like they're gay, but that's not what the joke is. Like, good on them. That turned out to not be the case at all. Yeah, they're just neighbors. We don't get a ton of them in this, but we do have the funny B story about Overton's speakers, like his full body speakers or whatever.
Yeah, he wants to put speakers in the like top of this leather chair, so when he sits in it, it's like stereo surround sound, but in his chair. And then he builds in some like vibration stuff in the bottom of it, so it'll it can be like a vibrating chair, like a massage chair. I mean, he just wants to make this thing everything it could be and more. He's so excited about this, you know, great find that he found on the side of the road. And yeah, and Kyle's a little bit like, that chair has bugs, like, please get it out of the apartment. And Overton's like, nothing in this apartment is mine. Like, it's all yours, which is the same story we've had with Joey and Chandler in a few years as well. You know, Joey's mad that like he doesn't have any money, so he never pays for any of the stuff. So yeah, so that's what's going on with them. And then the so there's kind of, again, this is an ensemble comedy. So you've got several stories going on. That's one of the side stories. Another one of the stories is Max, played by Erica Alexander, who is in the Oscar-nominated American Fiction this year.
Yeah, she is my favorite of the characters. I really like her look. I thought at first her acting, like, I wasn't sure, like, it seemed a little stiff to me. And then by the end, like, I'm fully won over. Her delivery is hilarious. I like her a lot.
Yeah, me too. I've liked her as an actress for a long time, so I'm always excited. Like, when I randomly, I didn't see American Fiction, but I saw her sitting behind somebody who was nominated, and I was like, hey, look at that. That's so cool. So she is great. She and Kyle have this thing, like Martin and Pam do, where they are just, they trade insults for no reason. They just don't like each other, and they always have something mean to say to one another. Well, this is kind of a big step if we were to do Will They Won't They with these two, because this is a big step. They've been trading insults all season, and now Max is going through something at work. She's this high-powered attorney. She's, you know, like a junior partner or up for a junior partner or something. She's an associate. She just is working really, you know, working really hard. And she gives advice to one of their very, you know, wealthy clients who you might recognize from In Living Color, or if you're a little bit older, from In the Heat of the Night. She was Tibbs' daughter. Max gives this girl, this woman, advice to get a prenup. And then the woman takes her advice, and then the guy breaks up with her. So then this, she's like, you got to fire.
She's a rich lady who found a young, hot dude with no money that she's going to marry.
She doesn't realize she's being taken advantage of. This guy is a con artist, basically, and is like, yeah, I'm hot. I'm going to, like, convince you to marry me without a prenup so that in 5 years I can take all your money, kind of a thing. And so Max realizes that and is like, hey, you should get a prenup. And then she mentions it to the guy, and the guy breaks up with her. And so she is like, I am your wealthiest client. You have to fire this, you know, associate who gave me bad advice. And so they are like, look, you're going to go on administrative leave. Like, you're going to.
Maxine's boss is the coroner who eats Jason's heart in Jason Goes to Hell by the Final Friday.
Oh my gosh.
I was happy I was able to, you know, pin that down while I was watching it. Continue.
So Max gets suspended, but not fired, because they say, you're too good of a lawyer for us to just fire you. So you're going to take an extended vacation for now while they figure out a reason to fire her, basically, is what they're doing. And she knows it. So she is all upset, and she goes home to the apartment to, like, you know, drown her sorrows and talk to her friends. But there's the other story going on, and that is centering around Khadijah, who has this love triangle. She's been dating this guy, Alonzo, and more recently, and earlier in the season, she had, like, a friendship that was a kind of maybe it would go somewhere, friends to lovers sort of thing, with an old friend of hers named Scooter. And he has moved to LA, and so they're not going to be in a relationship because he lives in LA, and so she started dating this guy, Alonzo. Well, she, you know, wasn't serious with Alonzo, and a few weeks ago had gone out to LA and hooked up with Scooter. And now Scooter is coming to interview for a job in New York to see if maybe they can make it work. And then Alonzo is asking her to move in with him. And so Khadijah, Queen Latifah, is facing this, like, do I move in with this guy who's really sweet? But, oh, like, I'm not going to be able to let Scooter go because I'm always going to have a thing for him, even if he doesn't live here. And I don't know. And so both guys show up at her apartment at the same time, right when Max comes in to try to have this conversation. And so Max is like, fine, whatever. Nobody cares about me. And she takes her bottle of tequila over to Kyle's place across the hall. And the very end of the episode, we see them in the nasty chair that Overton had rescued from the side of the road. And they're naked. And they have, whoops, had too much tequila and slept together.
Which is going to parallel exactly how the Brooklyn Nine-Nine episode ends. The Boyle and Gina relationship is actually similar to this. You know, people who are totally at odds and then they wake up in bed together. Yeah. So that's Maxine's deal. And yeah, if we could just back up for a second and just talk about Queen Latifah a little bit. Because, you know, we did our hip-hop stars in the 90s episode a few weeks back. You know, we talked about how the hip-hop artists at this time were using sitcoms to sort of cut their teeth and like, hey, you know, if anyone's interested, I might like to try acting. Queen Latifah has been doing this for several years now, and I was aware of her not really from her music. She showed up on The Fresh Prince. I recall correctly, she shows up once as a love interest for him, and the story is about he's not interested in her because she's overweight. He sees her as a friend, and then she shows up again playing herself in a different episode.
That's funny.
It's one of those like double dip situations.
Yeah.
She's also in the movie House Party 2, which I think probably predates this by a couple years.
Okay.
So she was definitely one of these like, yeah, Kid and Play is doing it. Will Smith is doing it. Like I want to do that too.
I want to
get into this TV and movies thing. What I love about Queen Latifah, you know, I've been watching all the Barbara Streisand movies for the Blank Check podcast, and they talk about how Streisand made it as a musician first, and she really wanted to move into the acting and even directing, and she really didn't want to have to make songs for these things. But again and again, she had to do it as this sort of bargaining chip.
Right.
Like they would let her direct a movie if she would record a song for the soundtrack. Queen Latifah, I feel like, with any acting assignment, shows up with a CD in hand. Here is the rap song that I have wrote for this movie. Like, I just think anything
right,
she is
the
in.
Opening credits, the song,
opening credits
like,
of this is Latifah.
Her.
All of the stuff I just mentioned, the Chicago, she has a rap song as like a bonus track on that.
Yes.
I just feel like she always has a song to tie into whatever she's doing.
I dig. So there's a funny little exchange in this episode because we have a guest star, Jerome Bettis, who's an NFL player, but he plays a delivery man in this episode, and he shows up at the magazine offices where Khadijah's like the, you know, main editor or whatever. He shows up to deliver, you know, something, and she's like, you know, you kind of look like that, you know, NFL player, Jerome Bettis. And he's like, yeah, well, you kind of look like Queen Latifah. And she's like, get on out of here, and like sends him on his way.
They loved those jokes. Like the Fresh Prince started doing that more and more, making these little winking references to his recording career, his
right.
like, real life celebrity. But yeah, so, you know, she's sort of ostensibly, like I said, you know, he's kind of the first among equals. Like she, you know, sort of like the main character. And for me, coming into this season finale, this is quite a whirlwind, her romantic triangle that you've already sort of outlined. So the guy she's seeing back home in New York gives her a house key as a present and invites her to move in with him in the cold open. That's
right.
Literally
yeah.
like the cold open is these offices like after hours or whatever. Will you move in with me? Cue the theme song.
Yes.
And then this scooter dude shows up out of nowhere and is just like, yeah, here I am. And so for me watching this, like understanding, I can't criticize the show for not fleshing out these characters when I haven't seen the episodes leading up to this that allow you to get to know them. But this whole story just seemed like Khadijah has no opinion about this. Like she's so passive and wishy-washy. Like the
yeah.
one guy says, will you move in with me? She says, I need to think about it. So, okay, fine. She's thinking about it. And then the other guy just comes in like a freaking bull in a china shop. And as the episode moves on, I learn, okay, they really do have a thing going.
Do you remember the scene where she's on the phone with Scooter and she's cracking up and like every, I mean, she's really like flirting and laughing and they're cracking up. She's on the phone and she's just cracking up, laughing so hard. And then she gets off the phone and her friends are all like, you're doing some pretty hard flirting there with Scooter. And she, you know, what about Alonzo? And she's like, it's no big deal. Scooter doesn't live here. You know, it's fine. Whatever. It'll be all right. Like, it's fine.
Yeah. All right. So, I mean, she is deliberately sort of like, yeah, she's aware of this indecision. But when this guy, I don't know, maybe it's just my personality. When this guy shows up unannounced, just like a wrecking ball, I'm surprised that she's so okay with it. And she just, yeah, she just doesn't seem to have an opinion about which one of these guys she likes, you know?
Well, look, I get the impression that she really likes Alonzo. He is a great guy. He is, you know, he's smart. He's a professor. He's everything that she should 100% want to be with. But she is hung up on Scooter. And so, you know, if it isn't going to work out with Scooter, she is happy to have this guy Alonzo as her backup and Scooter doesn't live there. So, you know, whatever. But she gets this, you know, thing dangled in front of her after she gets offered the keys of Scooter is interviewing for a job and wants to move back to New York and wants to try and make a go of it with her. And she realizes that, like, she's never going to say no to Scooter. And so she doesn't want to say no to Alonzo because if Scooter doesn't work out, he's the right guy and everything on paper that she would want. But he also has some self-respect and is like, I'm not going to be your backup.
Yeah. So I guess that's what I didn't totally understand was that her relationship with Scooter only ended because of like circumstance. Like she would be with him if it weren't that he moved away.
Right. And they were like, it was one of those things, I think, when he moved away that it was just kind of like, hey, you know, we're really good friends and we're not going to do a long distance thing, but you know, we have these feelings. And so, okay, that was just going to let it be what it was going to be.
Yeah. It's very sitcom-y the way it plays out because just everything, like everything happens in these big swoops, you know, like I said, will you move in with me happens in the cold open. Okay. And then yes, yeah, Scooter busts into town and is just like, here I am. And all that information all at once, like I am interviewing for this job, which means I am living here again, which means that now I want to get back together. And of course, she's not telling him anything. Like, and this, I guess, is like a, you know, real life thing. Like, you might not be forthcoming about that. But then, of course, like, they both show up in the same physical space, you know, like two scenes later. And it's just straight up like, who are you? Well, who are you?
Yeah.
And yeah, like, Scooter is a very good looking guy. I have to say, I feel like he would be my choice in terms of like sex appeal, but I don't like his ear to ear grin as he's like standing behind her while this other guy, Alonzo, is like, you know, like trying to suss this out and piece this together.
Yeah.
And the way he's kind of like smugly standing behind Latifah, like, I guess we see what this is just really, you know, when he has not been given the okay, like Latifah has not said, yes, I choose you.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's just because you didn't see the episodes from earlier on when he was living in the area and there was this, you know, thing with them. So for a person who watched the whole season, you're grinning just like Scooter is because you're like, you know, he's got the history. He's going to win out, you know.
I guess the one guy, Alonzo, kind of gets mad and goes to leave and she chases after him so they can have their little moment of dialogue. But he goes like, she's just like, yeah, I'm not really sure. And he's like, well, whatever.
Right. He basically is like, you know, who is this guy? Like, is this a thing I need to be worried about? Cause I thought we were moving towards more commitment. And she's like, well, and he's like, if you're not looking for the relationship that I'm looking for, we can just be done. And she's like, but I do have feelings for you. And he's like, sure, but you also have feelings for someone else. And that's not enough for me. And so, like, I'm not going to compete for that. Like, I'm not going to do that. Self-respect, like, good for him. You know what I mean? To me, it was all pretty realistic and kind of handled well. Like, yes, it, like what you're saying, they're both in the same space.
Yeah.
That's sitcom-y. But I really liked that it wasn't this, first of all, that it wasn't the guy at the center of this thing, right? And that both of the men, like, respected her decision and weren't trying to, like, beat each other up. You know what I mean? Like, they had a little bit of, like, a kind of look in, like, what's up, bro? I'm going to shake your hand harder than you want to shake mine or whatever. Yeah. But it's they both, it was like, this is your decision.
Yeah, they definitely weren't, like, fighting over her. I just thought that Scooter, he just was so presumptuous and, like, just his bravado was, right. Like,
but,
was,
I mean, he does have me. The history.
Yeah, and it wasn't until later on when he finally says, like, well, I did just show up here.
Right.
That I was like, okay, thank you. Like, that's all I needed was knew. For him to acknowledge at the beginning, like, oh, hey, I know you weren't expecting me or whatever, but he just never has any of that kind of energy.
No, he's too busy laughing that he's put his old friend and girl that he has this big ass crush on into this situation in the first place, which is also kind of funny.
When she comes back into her living room or whatever, she thinks at first that he's gone, like she lost both of them, but then no, Scooter was just like in the bathroom or whatever.
Yeah, he went upstairs to help Regine with something. She started choking on her spaghetti or whatever because she was sitting there. Oh, she got her hair stuck in the vent. Because she said she was going to go upstairs to the bedroom and listen through the vent because she wanted to know what was going on. And so I guess, like, she called for help and he went up and helped her.
Yeah. So we end with, like, multiple, you know, with them. They seem like they're getting together. We've got the more wacky sort of pair up with Maxine and Kyle. And so, yeah, you know, this one I feel like isn't as big a deal as MASH with the season finale of it all, but you definitely get the sense of things sort of coming to a head.
I would say the Max and Kyle thing is a big deal. Like, yeah, that was what it ended on. They had a reveal, like the Monica and Chandler reveal, where she, like, comes out from under the covers. Like, we see that he's half naked and somebody's cuddling with him, but we don't know who. And then she comes out from under the covers and the whole audience screams. And then they look at each other and notice that they're with each other and are like, ah, and start screaming and trying to get out of the chair and get away from each other. So the next episode, season two premiere, is called The Morning After. So they definitely are going to, you know, yeah, that was the big cliffhanger. They're going to do, sure, something with that Max and Kyle, mm-hmm, what happened thing when we come back in season two.
All right. So, yeah, that's kind of like true to form, you know, sort of classic maneuver. I don't know. I like this. You know, there's a quote from the pilot episode that I watched where one of them goes, did you ever think what the world would be like without men? And Queen Latifah goes, a bunch of fat, happy women and no crime. You know? I feel like that's sort of like the mission statement of this show. You know, like, it is in a lot of ways a little bit less sophisticated than Friends and Seinfeld and stuff, in the sense that, like, just like you were saying, the writing and stuff isn't quite as innovative, and yet the ladies themselves, like, the personalities and, yeah, everything are very fun.
Absolutely.
They say the word girl so often, like the drinking game of how many times, girl, you know, if you take a shot whenever they say girl.
And you know what? So you're picking up on something, though, that I think is really interesting, because when I was watching this, I was questioning myself, like, why, you know, aside from, you know, my inherent bias and, like, being a white girl, why was I more drawn to the Friends thing? And, you know, trying to justify, like, oh, is it written more, you know, whatever. And truthfully, having gone back and watching a bunch of those early episodes of Friends, I don't know that it is written better, you know, in quotes. I think that this is a Black experience. And the way that it's written and the way that they're talking is a Black experience. And it was not my experience, which was maybe why I didn't connect with me, or maybe why sometimes the conversation feels like it's scripted in a way. And I think it might just be that this is a window into a world that I didn't get to live. You know what I mean? And we've got pervasive, you know, Black culture, Black American culture now, 100%. But I don't know. There's just something about this like 90s thing. I don't think it's less sophisticated anymore. I think looking at it now, I think that's just bias.
I think everything you're saying is absolutely true. And I definitely don't want to lionize, especially like the early episodes of Friends. Right. Like there's some sort of amazing no. like works of gospel. But nonetheless, I can say
Seinfeld to me is different. To me, Seinfeld falls in a different category in terms of like the sophistication of writing and what they were
and
doing.
And just being different. Yeah. I'm just saying there are times in this where the writing, I think, is a little bit like sitcom autopilot in a way that like the bar would be raised, I think, in general, because of Seinfeld and Friends and stuff.
Yeah,
but again,
well, and also Fox, right? Like, look at the things that it's going up against. It was definitely more sophisticated than the other things on Fox. Maybe Rock, you know,
yeah,
but even
totally.
That.
Yeah, no, even yeah, the Rock episode we watched showed that. It was prestige in quotes. And, yeah.
Right.
All right, moving on to How I Met Your Mother.
How I Met Your Mother, Season 1, Episode 22, Come On.
Yep, so this is our first time talking about How I Met Your Mother on the podcast, but this is a sitcom we're both very familiar with. We watched this entire series start to finish together. This was a favorite of yours before we ever even met. I feel like there's a lot to talk about with How I Met Your Mother in general. There's a lot to like. There's a lot to criticize. It's very much a product of its time. What I'll say first, maybe as a positive, I think in general, How I Met Your Mother is very funny. You know, I think they have a lot of funny ideas in the stories and the scripts. This is a product of the mid-2000s, so this is a point where we are very much in that TV renaissance, golden age, whatever they were calling it. You know, you're watching The Wire and Breaking Bad and stuff. Just
2005,
TV.
Yeah.
TV in general has gotten really good, and I think it's one of those rising tide raises all ships type thing, where just to be a show of any kind on a major TV network, like you can't be on autopilot anymore. You can't be like, let's do an episode where they get mad at each other, something. Like you needed to really have something.
Yeah, there has to be a concept. There needs to be some sort of through line, even if we aren't serialized as much as the later ones are. There's something going on. Some of the storylines do connect to the, you know, previous episodes. But you can always still drop in and know what's going on for at least the B and C plot, or maybe the A and C plot. You know, there's always something going on that it's easy to drop into, because we're still just in the birth of like the streaming time.
Yeah, there's just a general mark of quality to the comedy, I feel like. Like you watch it and there's just a lot going on and it's funny and the actors are good. Where it breaks down for me is like the characters and the dynamics and the relationships and stuff sometimes. So let's just outline what's the basic deal with How I Met Your Mother.
So How I Met Your Mother, it's a group of 20-something friends. Three of them have been friends since college. Marshall and Lily, they've been dating since they were like 18 or 19, their freshman year of college. Ted was Marshall's roommate, and so they've just been friends. They've been friends since that first week at Wesleyan, and then they have met some other friends in the intervening time, right? So they meet this guy, Barney, who is a womanizer, kind of, he's the like particular character in the show that Neil Patrick Harris, who plays him, when they did How I Met Your Father, he was like, no, they absolutely couldn't have a character like me on this show. Like, it absolutely couldn't happen again. And no, Barney won't be coming back to appear on How I Met Your Mother because this guy is awful. Like, sure. No, we can't make this character can't continue.
this is a direct result of Neil Patrick Harris's cameo in Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle, right?
So, well, yeah. So originally they had envisioned the character to be like a John Belushi type. Mm-hmm. And they had done, you know, that's what they were looking for. And then, like you said, after Harold and Kumar, Neil Patrick Harris, the casting director, actually is like, you know, I know you're looking for this thing, but you should look at this too.
Yeah, this was a moment. Like, for people our age who grew up with Doogie Howser.
Right.
And then Neil Patrick Harris had kind of, you know, from a mainstream point of view, gone into obscurity a little bit. He's sure. A Broadway guy. He's a super talented
dude.
Well,
and he wasn't even on Broadway. He was Mark in Rent in L.A. So okay. He was doing a lot of theater in L.A. and musicals and stuff. But that was like drama kids knew about that.
Yeah. And you could see him in random Law and Order episodes and shit like
exactly.
that.
Like, he was the child actor that made it out, but, you know, was like unscathed, but wasn't super successful.
Right. And so Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle comes out. There's this great moment in the middle of the movie where Neil Patrick Harris as himself, quote unquote, is this total, you know, fucking pussy hound, crazy, weirdo, obnoxious lunatic. And everybody loves it.
Yeah, that guy was so funny because it was such like, you're just like, whoa, Doogie, what's going on?
Yeah, exactly. And this was, look, I'm not going to say it's the first time that anyone ever played against type, but I feel like since then, this has become a much more common thing, you know, in a sense, Betty White's whole persona is this, right?
And then playing you've got, what's his name from Dawson's Creek doing it and Don't Blame the Bitch and Apartment 23 or whatever.
Exactly. But this is definitely, for a certain generation, this is one of the biggest, best examples of somebody just kind of coming out of left field and really subverting your view of them. And so that really kind of thrust him back into the public eye at, I think, just kind of the right time when the show was coming out. And so now Barney, as we get him, is this wild parody of Neil Patrick Harris, who somewhere in this timeline, it becomes known that he's gay.
Right.
And that's
he was out, like, he was never in the closet, but it was one of those things, like, this was, you know, before the, like, crazy everybody's inside your, you know, ass space of the internet.
Like we said, he was in obscurity, like, so no one cares.
Nobody cared, nobody knew, but, like, he was, and then he was, like, and then he got this, and he got started getting famous for playing this Lothario, and he's like, by the way, I'm married to a chef, guy.
I think that's what makes this character work, you know? Right. We keep talking all the time.
It's very winking.
He's doing, there's a meta aspect to this where, like, we say that Michael J. Fox is able to let the goodness shine through even though his character is kind of a schmuck. With Neil Patrick Harris, you have that with his acting, but you have this extra aspect to it that you know what he's like in real life and what his, you know, just his real life persona helps undercut this.
Sure.
And just make it sort of go down easier.
Right.
But that said, it still doesn't go down that easy to me. And I guess the reason why...
Unlike Barney's girlfriends. Oh, yeah.
Exactly. That's a lot of the kind of humor we get on the show. And that's fine. This is sort of just what I want to kind of get off my chest about How I Met Your Mother, is that there's a lot of, you know, what edgy, whatever you want to call it. There's a lot of humor that could be, you know, seen as problematic or whatever. And it's fine. Like, all of that stuff, I guess... What bothers me is that you're constantly seeing Barney do his crazy schemes where
he's always trying to lie to women and like create some
sort of thing. He gets women to sleep
with
him by tricking them and saying he's an astronaut and he's been to Mars and the only way to save the planet is that they have to sleep with him. All these silly things.
No, his whole point in life is to smash, like that. He's just out there trying to smash as many times a day. There was an episode at some point where he was like going to hit 2,000 conquests. Right. And they were like celebrating his 2000 conquests. And what doesn't hold up today, right? Because like, like he said in the press, this character could not be recreated today. I can still watch the show and laugh. Like, it's not unwatchable to me in the way I think it might be for some people. I still think it's funny. I'm like, oh yeah, you know, okay, that wouldn't pass today. But the part of this that makes me be like, that wouldn't that wouldn't work at all, and that doesn't ring true, is that his friends at some point all kind of get into it. Like, yeah. They're all either helping him, or even when they make fun of him, they still love him. You right. know what I mean? There's all, like,
this.
That's the part where I'm like, we're all celebrating his 2000th conquest. Yeah, Would we do that?
This is one of my issues with it. I have a multi-pronged complaint. So first is that, like you're saying, the friends, especially the women, you know, they'll roll their eyes at him a lot of times.
And they'll give him shit or smack him or whatever. But it's not... like, we can't hang out with you right. anymore because you're problematic.
But the reason for that is that so many of these women fall for his dumb schemes.
Right.
And Robin and Lily sort of correctly say, like, well, if they're that dumb, then I guess they deserve it.
But that's not correctly. Like, that's really not okay.
Right.
that is pitting women against other women.
But it also, right. And it just creates this weird, like, it's hard to know how to look at it because it's a sitcom. So it's heightened and silly.
Of course.
So it's like his schemes are sillier than they would ever be. And when a girl is dumb, she's dumber than she would ever be. What bothers me is that the show is drawing this bright line between you have cool, smart girls like Robin and Lily, and that's who you want as your friends to have right. around and hang out with.
Or to date.
Right. But don't worry. Well, to date if you're someone like Ted or later the reformed Barney. But if you're...
Or Marshall, who wants to date Lily, who wants to be Lily.
But if you're a Lothario like Barney, don't worry. There's this endless supply of hot idiots in every bar in the city that will fall for this stuff.
Right.
And so when you say I watch it and it's still funny, that's the thing, is it is. Like, his schemes and plans are very funny. What's so frustrating to me is that the adjustment that I wish they would have made is let him be like Wile E. Coyote with the Roadrunner.
Let his him
plans
fail more.
Not work. They don't always work, and right. sometimes they backfire. But so often it does seem like his crazy schemes to get laid work because these girls are stupid. And again, the show is just entrenching this idea that, like, you've got the smart ones like Robin, yes. but there's plenty of stupid ones. And to me, it's an unforced error because you could have all of that humor and fun, but just have him be the butt of the joke instead of all these dumb girls that he keeps. You see them walking out of his apartment every time, you know, you walk into it.
Sure. He is treating dating like a game. He's going to have fun with it. He's going to come up with all these right. random
We should
schemes.
Add, this was around the time of The Game by Neil yes. Strauss and the whole notion of the pickup artist
exactly.
and all that stuff.
He was right in line with all of that, and he has a group of friends around him that tend to try to keep him grounded in some ways, but also, you know, still love him for his crazy, silly antics.
Yeah, and look no further than Empty Nest for all the many examples of, you know, you want to have a cad in your cast. It's a show about single people, of course. So yeah, it's, again, I like all of his antics. I just wish they had made that adjustment, like I said, and let him fall on his face a little bit more. And so it's not like, hey guys, maybe you should be a little more like Barney.
Yeah. And then you have Robin, who we meet in the first episode as someone that Ted meets, and he has a date with her and it goes poorly, and it just sort of sets it up for Ted, this being Ted's story. So it's told in kind of a Wonder Years fashion where you have this Bob Saget narration, and it starts oftentimes with the shots of the kids.
Yes.
Where he's like, all right, kids, let me tell you how I met your mother. And here are all the stories of my foibles right. along the way.
Now, let's pause on that for a second, because this is something that bugged me since day one. It's one of those things I'm supposed to just have fun with and suspend my disbelief about. But when you are a young man, the age of a young Josh Radner, say,
right.
your voice pretty much is what it is. When you get old, it might be a little gravelier, a little gruff. You don't go from sounding like Josh Radner to sounding like Bob Saget. And it always seemed like such a bizarre choice to me to be like, well, they did it on the Wonder Years. Like, yeah, Daniel Stern was a 45-year-old man looking back on his times as a child
right.
when he was Fred Savage. So, of course, and even then it was a little silly. Like, you had to kind of roll with it. But with that, it was fun to hear Daniel Stern's funny old guy voice juxtaposed with
sure.
young, cute Fred Savage. With this one, it just seems so strange to me that the voice of Bob Saget, that's very distinct and yes. unique, is supposed to somehow come from this Ted character, this Josh Radnor, who just has a completely different voice. I just always thought that was silly.
And I think that you're being way too pedantic.
Yeah, it's neither here nor there.
The whole point of it is that Bob Saget is America's dad. You're
sure.
a fan of sitcoms. You get that, right?
Yeah.
So you have America's dad sitting his kids down and being like, all right, kids, let me tell you how I met your mother. And then we get these tellings of stories through the actual characters. It never bothered me or even really occurred to me that their voices sounded different because it was this play acting thing of like a story. The piece of that did rub me the wrong way is like, why is this man telling his kids all the women he fucked before he met the mother?
Yeah.
That's where I'm a little bit like, I would neither want to be a child in this conversation nor the adult in this conversation.
Yeah, it is weird the details he goes into. It's also fun trivia to know that a few years out from the end of this show, they had to just film all of these reaction shots with these kids. Because they realized, like, they're going through puberty, they're growing up, and they're not going to look the same.
Yeah, not even a few years out. It was within, like, the first two, three years of the show.
So you just have all of these shots for years on end of this, you know, these teenage boy and girl just nodding or, like, giving these generic, like, what then, dad, or something.
Or eye rolls or whatever.
Yeah,
they
exactly.
say very few lines. It's usually just them sitting there staring at the camera with, like, withering looks of, oh great, another dad story.
Yeah. So aside from that aspect of it, just that framework, which yes, is just the fun stunt casting of Bob Saget, when you get into the actual stories, so this is another show that's trying to be the next Friends, right? It's trying to be a new fun show about a group of friends with no major concept. One of them's not an alien or anything. It's just a down the middle show. And this was on at a time when I was basically this age and I was a single guy living in the city. And so it's funny, you know, I didn't watch this really on purpose, but it would come on when I was stretching before I would go for my run. And I was just generally familiar with it. And like I said, I always had fun with the humor of it, but it would disappoint me in the same way when I was a kid and I was looking to Saved by the Bell or Charles in Charge for a little bit of insight into, like, what is this world of dating and talking to girls like as a teenager? It's a little bit of that same thing where you're like, yeah, I know it's a sitcom, but I kind of want to, like, glean a little bit of something. Like, I'm interested in seeing stuff that's about people in my same demographic, my same life situation. Right. And so I think it's all the more frustrating to me that I don't know that it has a ton of insight about that. And it does have a weird mentality, I think, about relationships and dating and stuff. So now we can get into the episode because this begins, right? Minute one is the gang sans Robin sitting around their table
McLaren's,
at the bar.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And everyone's going, Ted, you gotta get over Robin. And Ted's going, but I love her. She's Robin. She's the one. And it just, it's like post-traumatic stress for me, just bringing me back to this show and like, oh, right, that's Ted's deal. He's the quote unquote hopeless romantic who's just obsessed with the notion of romance in general.
Who's
and obsessed
actually
with
just
Robin.
A bad boyfriend and a jackass over and over and over again.
Yeah, like it's just like I just find him exhausting. And so catch us up on what the Ted Robin deal is.
Right. So Ted is the epitome of the like in quotes nice guy that we talk about now, right?
Yeah.
That was not in the nomenclature back in 2004, 2005 when this show was on, you know, when this season or this episode in particular, I think, aired in like spring 2006, right? So the idea of an in quotes nice guy didn't exist then. And he is, like you said, a hopeless romantic. and he just is always trying to find his wife. He is looking for the girl that's going to be his wife, and he says that from basically date one with people.
Yeah.
So what happens with Robin and Ted in the very first episode is he meets her, I don't remember how, in some sort of meet-cute situation. They go on a date. They end the date. It's been kind of awkward. They don't kiss because he, like, you know, miffs, and then he's like, then he like leaves or whatever, goes and gets the blue French horn, comes back, and then on their first date says, I love you. And yeah. She's like, and that's the end of episode one. So then they decide to be friends throughout season one. She, I think, dates somebody else. He dates somebody else, you know, whatever. And then his girlfriend moves away. Ted's girlfriend moves away to take a baking internship or baking fellowship in Germany.
Same old story, right? We've been through this. There's always something that makes a geographic
move.
Makes
the girlfriend go away, right? So the girlfriend goes away. He tells Robin that they broke up and he and Robin almost hook up. And then his phone rings and it's the girlfriend. And Robin realizes that Ted's lied to her and that they aren't broken up yet, but they were about to break up because she was, you know, kind of dating this other guy or almost dating this other guy. So then their friendship falls apart as well. And now Ted and Robin can't be friends. And then only recently, like a few episodes before the episode that we watched, do they just, they, you know, start being friends again. Robin is like, you know, I'm mad at you for lying to me, but I understand, you know, I understand and it's all right. Like, we're going to be friends, but you know, whatever. And now Ted's like, okay, I'm back in. I got to do another big gesture. I got to do a big gesture because, you know, I don't have anybody on the pipeline. I just broke up with the baker girlfriend and there's no Robin. And I'm thinking about Robin all the time. So he's like, I'm going to do one last big play for Robin. And if it doesn't work, I'm giving it up for good. It'll be a clean break. We'll be friends, but I promise I'm going to give it up. So he's decided to hire a string quartet. They paint their instruments blue. He fills her entire apartment with roses and he stands there waiting for her to come home.
Yeah, so this is pretty insufferable, in my opinion. I mean, look, the basic foils of you're going to have the one guy be the hopeless romantic. And, you know, in general, the fact that you want the protagonist of the sitcom about dating to be a guy who's obsessed with finding love, like, sure, that makes sense.
Sure.
And the foils of the romantic guy versus the more down-to-earth girl, like, sure, that's a good setup. But yeah, as it plays out, I do find him insufferable. And it's another one of these things of like, it's a sitcom. We need to understand that it's all heightened and silly and not take it too seriously.
Right.
So I try to think of like, okay, if he's like sneaking into her apartment while she's away and hiring the string quartet and doing all these things, should I think of it more as like the real life analog to that would be something a little more low key?
Right.
But I don't know. Any way I look at it, I'm just like, oh God, I would hate this.
No, it's love bombing, right? But see, here's the thing. Back in 2006, when I was watching this, I was newly married and I thought Ted was just the greatest.
You're like the woman she talks to later in the episode.
I am, because so later in the episode, Robin's like, who does that? Who goes so over the top? And the doctor, whoever she was talking to, was like, yeah, Nobody does that. And she's like, I know, nobody does that. And she was like, no, Robin, nobody does that.
Yeah.
Like, it's so romantic. And I remember when I first watched this show, back when it was airing, I agreed. I was like, Ted is a great guy. There, again, no such term as love bombing didn't exist in the culture. This nice guy thing didn't exist in the culture. He just was that. He was doing all the things that you want somebody to do for you.
To me, it boils down to this, because this particular scenario is Robin comes home probably from work.
Yes.
And Ted has borrowed her spare key that she normally leaves with Lily. He's borrowed the spare key so he could get into her apartment, set up this string quartet. So when she comes back from work, thinking she's walking into her own empty apartment, it's going to be this string quartet. So here's what I would say. There are surprises and there are surprises. To me, the acceptable thing would be to say, hey, I have an idea, or I have a surprise for you, or I have something I want to do, but don't ask me what it is. Can we do something at such and such time or whatever? That would be nice. And then the person shows up and surprise, look at what I did. It's even more grand than anything you ever expected.
This is because you don't like last minute plans.
Yeah, this is because, but I don't think this is that crazy. If I were Robin coming home from a long day at work where, not to mention her coworker is constantly trying to hitting hit on her.
Yes, who by the way is Allison Hannigan's real life husband.
Okay, that's funny. But yeah, she's coming home from a long day at work, going into your own space. Like, to me, this would be a violation.
Oh, no, I completely agree with you. I just don't know that your alternative scenario is any better. I would much rather just be surprised. Now, I get the whole thing, like, if this was a guy that I was dating, so now I'm going to, like, fast forward in my life to when, during this show, like, during the run of this show, I got divorced. And I couldn't watch this show for a while because the romantic things that Ted was always doing and, like, the hopeless romantic stuff would either, A, make me really sad, and B, make me double sad because dating sucks and this show just shows you over and over and over again how much dating sucks. But then later on when I went back to the show while single and I was like, ugh, don't be in my house. I don't even know you. This is so creepy. And yeah, it super creeped me out. So I get what you're saying. Now, that aside, if it's someone that you know, like Ted and Robin are now friends and they're part of a friend group and there is this sort of connection thing, or if you're in a relationship, yes, do the big thing, do the big gesture, surprise me. Like, I want that.
We get Robin's response and she says, why can't it just be, let's go for sushi? Why does it always have to be a string quartet or a trip to Paris? And I could not nod my head forcefully
yes,
enough.
No, like, I was exactly completely agreeing with her in that moment. Yep, it was over the top. It was too much.
And then Ted proceeds to channel Ross from Friends, basically, and start dealing with ultimatums and neediness. And
yes,
like, it's now or never, it's all or nothing. And again, it's like we were talking about the other day.
Yeah, if you can't say yes, then that means you mean no, and so I'll leave. And then he leaves and goes back to the bar, and he's like, I'm gonna try again!
Yeah, and I think it's just a lack of empathy and perspective. It's a lack of, I don't know, it's
no,
just
no, he's
like,
too wrapped up in his own shit. It's a narcissism.
Yes, exactly. It's just a short-sightedness. It's like, my goal is to be settled down with a lady. She fits the description.
And every girl wants that, don't they? That's what it is. It's like the, I know I'm great, doesn't every girl want to be with me sort of mentality that leads to this like incel thing.
Well,
right?
He says at one point, he says, it's meant to be because I need it to be. And so when he said that, it is kind of shocking to me that that was not meant as the show is turning on him and showing his foibles.
Yeah, no.
Because he says that and I'm like, okay, so he's going to see the error of his ways and the show is going to sort of take the stance of like, you're going too far. And it sort of continues to validate him and be like, no, this like, hey guys, you know, he's right. He needs it to be, so it is.
So he's going to make it to be. So he says to Barney, hey Barney, remember that girl that you dated?
Oh God, yes.
That was studying Native American cultures. And Barney's like, yeah. And he was like, well, are you still in touch? And Barney's like, of course not. But so he gets in touch and they go and they meet this girl. And the girl is like, ew, like every one of Barney's conquests is like gross, but still meets up with him anyway. And then Ted, using his, you know, oh, I'm so heartbroken. And it's just, I'm such a hopeless romantic, convinces her to teach him how to do a rain dance so that he can make it rain so that Robin won't go camping with her coworker who wants to sleep with her.
Yeah. I mean, this whole thing is like almost beneath comment.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if it's better or worse that it's a white girl that's telling him this instead of having to drag out a Native American to teach him to do this rain dance. Like,
right,
just the whole existence of it is like vaguely problematic. I feel like it's like talking about spirit animals and
yes,
stuff that like
yes,
you're not supposed to do anymore. But yeah, this skinny white girl is like, here, do this, you know, jump around like this. And he does it. And again, same thing I'll say about Barney. Like, okay, this is a sitcom. It's people being being silly.
Right.
So by all means, let's have this happen and laugh at it and see how dumb he is.
And you've got Barney, well, it doesn't right away, right? So you've got Barney sitting there drinking beers, laughing at the two of them, being like, this is ridiculous. You shouldn't be doing this. Let's go out and meet girls. Like, this is dumb. Just kind of like, you know, throwing eggs at the plan the whole time. And then midway through, Ted stops and looks at this girl and is like, wait, have you ever seen a rain dance before? And she's like, no, but I've read about it. And I watched a microfilm one time,
yeah,
or microfiche or something. And he's like, oh my God, this is ridiculous. And so then he gets upset and gives up, and then she leaves. And then he starts just going crazy and doing more movements anyway. And Barney's like, what are you doing? And he was like, I don't know. I don't think God cares if I do a rain dance right. It's my intent that matters, and I don't have any other options. I'm out of options. The only thing I can do, because so he's like now not, he's not just a hopeless romantic, he's completely hopeless. And so he's like, all I can do is just keep being crazy and hope and put the words out there in the universe and that Barney, I want it to rain.
Barney is being the voice of reason, yeah, at this point. And again, it kills me that this is the rare time the show should be embracing his point of view. Because Barney's like, no, what you should do is forget about it and go find some other girl, which is exactly right. You don't need to trick her and tell her you're the ghost of Steve McQueen or whatever. But yeah, just go move on with your life. That's the solution.
Right. And look, I don't think the show at this point is taking Ted's side of things. Things, right?
Well, I'm not saying it completely embraces it, but the fact that the end of the show is it does rain, he does run over to Robin, and have it has that same tone as those season finales of Friends,
yes,
had.
It does.
The music swells and it's raining because rain is romantic.
I mean, she sticks her head out the window and he's holding up something. What is he holding up? No, he doesn't have a blue French horn this time. He's like, come downstairs.
Yeah, he's just yelling to her.
Come down here. And she's like, no, you come up. It's raining. And he's like, I know. I made it rain. I did something bigger than big. Just come down here. And she's like, you're crazy. I don't want to. And then he runs up and she goes and gets a raincoat or something and goes like she's going to go outside. But then he's standing in front of her door and they kiss and he spends the night. And after the end of the first season, just like with Ross and Rachel, just like all the other will they, won't they's, by the end of the first season, we have this glimmer of, oh, they will. They're going to get together. Big kiss.
Yeah. And of course, we know from having watched the whole series, this goes in all kinds of crazy directions.
Right. Because it's established right away, early on in the season, they call Robin Aunt Robin.
Yes.
So we know from like episode 1 or 2 that Robin isn't the mother.
Right. And it's just one of those things. The title is How I Met Your Mother. Yes. And he meets her right away. There needs to be more of a hook of it. So yeah, she's like the weird red herring that we know. We don't know how it's going to go down, but we know, yeah, she's going to end up as a friend. So, yeah, and then, of course, the other story going on is, like some of our other season finales, we have the Marshall and Lily thing, where they're going to have a sort of a monkey wrench thrown into their spokes. They come back to a voicemail or answering machine message inviting Lily to some sort of out-of-town or abroad art program.
Yeah, San Francisco, she's applied for some graduate-level art program, so she has, while Marshall's in law school, she took a job as a kindergarten teacher in the city, and that's what she's doing, but she went to school for art, and she is an artist, and that's what she has always wanted to do, but he's going to law school, so they need to have steady income, so she's teaching, and that's what's going on, but she puts in for this summer institute at this university in San Francisco, where she can do art, and she's a teacher, so she can do that, but they are supposed to be getting married. They're engaged. They get engaged in season one, and they're supposed to be getting married in the fall, like right after her summer break is over, right? And she didn't tell Marshall about this fellowship thing, and he hears about it when he listens to the answering machine message, and Lily's on the phone with Robin telling her just to answer the door because, no, she doesn't have the spare key, but just, knock on the door. Somebody will be there, whatever, kind of a thing. And she gets off the phone, and then we start this, like, kind of big, wide-ranging fight between, yeah, Marshall and Lily. So Marshall and Lily have this thing in their relationship where they say pause in the middle of a fight, and they'll go out to dinner. They'll go hang out with friends. Like, they are such a solid couple that it's like, yeah, we're mad at each other about this little thing right now, and we'll have it out and we'll have a big fight and whatever, but we don't need to do it now. We can pause and go live our life, right? So they keep throughout the episode putting this argument on pause. But basically what it comes down to is Lily didn't tell him that she had applied for this. And then she was like, I wasn't going to go anyway. I just wanted to see if I could get it. That's really cool. And then as they argue more, Marshall's like, what the hell are you doing? Why would you even apply? Why would you even think about it? She's like, I wasn't even really thinking about it. Marshall's like, you can't go to this. We're getting married. And she's like, the hell? What do you mean I can't go to this? You don't get to tell me what to do. And it just keeps devolving and devolving until where Lily's like, I've given up so much so that you can be in law school, and I'm a teacher, and I never wanted to be a kindergarten teacher. I want to do art. Like, why aren't you supporting me? And he's like, I'm happy to support you, but you didn't tell me. And she's like, you're not supporting me because you told me I couldn't go. And he's like, but we're supposed to get married.
Well, you also have the same thing as Sam from Cheers, this sort of like, you're going to forget me, or anything right. could happen while you're away right. for so long.
There is an insecurity there for sure. And they have been together since they were like 18, 19, you know, and they're what's supposed to be like 24, 25 now. They're super young. And so that was, you know, that's kind of all coming to a head. Like, did they move too fast? What's going on? And so Ted has this like glorious night, right? This thing that he's been waiting for in the will they, won't they of it all, the whole first season. And he comes back after, you know, a wonderful night having spent it with Robin. And he comes, walks up to the front stoop of their brownstone apartment building that they live in. And Marshall's sitting there holding the engagement ring because Lily decided to go. And then Marshall was like, well, if you go, I'm calling off the wedding. And Lily didn't want that. Lily wanted it to be like, I'm going to go. We'll be long distance. We'll do a thing. Support me. And Marshall couldn't do that. He didn't have the, like, he was weak and insecure. Yeah. He just, like, he couldn't do it. And so they ended up breaking up.
We definitely have everything being topsy-turvy by the end of this. We're fully into the time now where a season finale is a real thing.
It's
and
a, big,
a season
yeah, they,
has an arc.
Exactly. And they always do a cliffhanger. There's always some big thing that happens that then they're going to have, you know, season two, episode one and two generally try to, like, deal with the fallout in one way or another. And in this case, in two different ways.
Yeah, I mean, look, it definitely satisfies. If you've been watching the season, you know, up until this point, you get, you know, you get your will they, won't they, not conclusion, obviously, but you get like a major step in that. You get a major shakeup with Lily and Marshall. Yeah. And so, yeah, you know, this does what it's supposed to do.
Yep.
Moving on to Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Season one, episode 22, Charges and Specs.
So yeah, we've never covered Brooklyn Nine-Nine before. I was very much into this show when it came out. This, you know, we talk all the time about how the later ones, like, we weren't watching TV anymore because we were older. But this one is like so recent that it's almost sort of when I started getting back into watching TV. And yeah, you know, I liked Andy Samberg from SNL and, you know, The Lonely Island and stuff like that. But I think what really made this kind of a must-see for me was Joe Latrulio from The State.
Yeah.
I was a super fan of The State, the sketch show from MTV in the 90s, to the point that, you know, to this day, those guys have been sort of scattered into all these different things. And I feel this sort of personal pride when I see Ken Marino or Michael Ian Black or Thomas Lennon show up in something.
Yes. The whole, like, when the Wet Hot American Summer resurgence happened, I was like, other people knew about this. I love that movie.
Yeah, exactly. So it definitely, Joe Latrulio being even a, you know, supporting part of this cast made it like, all right, I have to check this out. And I always liked it. I always thought it was funny. It's basically just a workplace comedy that uses the police element of it to, you know, bring in some interesting storylines and stuff. But it's just, I think it's working at a really high level.
Yeah. So this was not one I watched. So I kind of, like you, we talk about this all the time. Like, as I got older into college, I stopped watching as much television. And then when I got out of college and, like, you know, kind of settled down, got married, I was watching more television. And then when I got divorced, I stopped watching TV. Like, it was this weird thing in my world of I stopped listening to music, I stopped watching TV, because all of my entertainment was sort of wrapped up in this person that I had been. And so this show comes out right at that time. And so it was just not one, even though I'm a big fan of SNL, also big fan of The State. And Andy Samberg was never my favorite on SNL. Neither. I did like his, you know, digital shorts and the Lonely Island stuff, but I wasn't going to be interested in a starring vehicle for him. Yeah. Also, I wasn't really watching television. So it was just so interesting that this show, it is everything that I would like. And this is the very first episode of this show that I have ever watched. And I love it.
Yeah. Samberg himself is definitely like, I was not first in line to see Hot Rod. Right. You know, I do like his pop star that movie.
Oh, with, that. Yeah, that was
the
funny.
Lonely Island guys. But yeah, his character in this is very much, I think, a throwback to the young Tom Hanks, Bill Murray characters. He's a pure extrovert that just gets a kick out of himself and the world. And he just likes to have fun and be silly and goofy, and he's gonna put a fun, silly spin on everything he does. And like a lot of those early Bill Murray and Tom Hanks roles, he's also very competent, you know? So that's what the whole sort of premise of his character is going to be, is that he's actually a good detective, even though he doesn't take anything seriously. And what he wants out of life more than anything is just to see somebody do a silly dance or something like that.
Right.
You know, like that's his whole thing. And it surrounds him with all of these great supporting characters. There are no other straight white men on the show besides Andy Samberg and, of course, Hitchcock and Scully, who are famously incompetent. And I guess you have Lucullio, but he's kind of a dumbass too. Like, the show just really gets the memo about inclusivity. I don't know, it has this tapestry of characters that we'll talk about, Andre Brower and Stephanie Beatrice's character. Like, they're all
Chelsea
really good
Peretti.
And funny.
Yeah,
exactly. So this episode begins, total product of its time. They did this more in movies than in TV shows, but every movie in the 2000s and 2010s began in some crazy scene that you didn't know what's happening, and then it pauses and somebody goes, I bet you're wondering how we got here. And then you rewind back to the beginning of the story.
A week ago.
Yeah. And that's what this does.
So we have Jake, and he has been investigating this man who is like a good person in the
community.
Like
a political muckety-muck,
some famous guy. He's in charge of, or he runs a community center, and he's like always giving back, always doing charitable things. Seems very much like a man of the people, kind of good guy. But Jake, Andy Samberg's character, has been getting intel from like his drug dealers, people that he knows on the street, that actually this guy is laundering money for drug dealers.
Yeah, this is Gus Fring from Breaking Bad. It's like that kind of figure.
Yeah. And so he keeps trying to talk to the guy, and the guy keeps putting him off. And so he goes to his basketball game and, like, you know, gets in it and tries to talk to him while they're playing, like, one-on-one. And he's like, this is ridiculous. So the guy writes to his friend, who is the police commissioner, and is like, yo, this guy's harassing me. So we have Andy Samberg in the office of Captain Holt, and the commissioner's in there too, and they're like, you got to back off this guy, and we're going to do an investigation about the harassment, and until then you are on administrative leave.
Yeah, this is a very standard situation for Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Captain Holt is reprimanding Jake Peralta. He's gotten in trouble, ruffled somebody's feathers. So Captain Holt, right, Andre Brower, great character in this show, like really just
funny,
very, very funny. I will say, in my opinion, his character jumps the shark a little bit later in the show. So this is one of those, like, he is a quintessential straight man, no pun intended, because his character is gay, but he's a very like straight arrow. He's in charge. He's authoritative. Andre Brower brings this great theatrical deep voice to it and this very serious presence. And of course, the humor comes from, again and again, he'll undercut that. He'll say something or do something a little silly. And that's what makes it funny, because it is a sitcom after all. But it's one of those things, they started doing this with some of the Office characters in the late later seasons too, where I feel like in the last season or two, it's like the ratio is off and he's silly too much of the time.
Too much of the time.
And it's like you're not undercutting it anymore. You just are this. You're just
that.
A silly guy with a deep voice.
Right.
But back in these episodes, it's great.
And so he reminds me of, and it's not the same characterization, but in terms of just like the straight man aspect of it and the sort of like gruff seriousness, he reminds me of, what's his name from Parks and Rec?
Oh, Nick Offerman?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. He's got a little bit of that just like, yes, I'm very serious and I never laugh. And so, you know, like that's where a lot of the humor comes from. That's why Peralta always gets so excited about like, oh my God, are we going to see the captain, you know, do a dance? Are we going to see, you know, whatever it
is. Yeah, I was going to say, so in this episode, like at every turn, Captain Holt is doing something that like shocks and delights both Jake and Amy. And Amy is kind of, she's more serious. Like she will just sort of get a little smirk or a little twinkle in her eye when she sees Captain Holt do something unexpected. But Jake's face, it's like the, you know, it's like the little kitty cat who, when you hand them, you know, the catnip lollipop, he's just like, ah!
Yes, that is the crux
with
the of
big
his
smile.
Yes, that's the crux of his performance. Both he and Amy idolize Captain Holt, but with Amy, it's like she's like a grown-up Tracy Fleck, right? She's a rule follower. Okay. She's very much a by-the-book, overachiever type person. And she just has all of this respect for Captain Holt just as this professional hero. And
right.
She wants nothing more than to impress him. Whereas Peralta, you know, isn't as interested in that. He respects him for those reasons. He more just finds it hilarious that he's so serious and like sort of a parody of himself.
Right.
He's sort
like,
of got this,
who's even
really
is?
Like this?
Yeah. Who even are you? He's like, well, how do you know how to ballroom dance? Like, what is going on?
Yeah, exactly. So that's always the dynamic. And we see a lot of times in this episode, Amy taking Jake's side, like thinking he really is onto something and having this sort of like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm saying this, Captain Holt, but we need to go behind your back or whatever.
Well, like, she at one point, she's like, my name is Amy Santiago, and I'm here to tell you that Captain Holt, I'm sorry I disagree because I agree with Jake and we need to look into this. And my name is Amy and I'm done speaking now. Like it was so, she was so awkward. And I was like, what is happening? Why is she saying her name twice?
Yes. And there's a lot of fun. Just fun humor with the dialogue like that. Now, one thing I noticed was very of its time and kind of dated was the running joke of Chelsea Peretti's character, Gina, doing the emoji talk. Her character, she always has like the E story, you know, she's always just like off to the side doing something funny and silly.
Right.
And she goes like, yeah, the English language is not sufficient to express, you know, the depth
of my emotion.
Right, exactly. So I'm going to start incorporating emoji into my language. So she'll just be like, I think you're crazy. Smiley face, winky face, eggplant emoji or something.
Well, and her delivery is what is so captivating, right?
Yeah.
Because she is doing this, like, could very easily slide into this, like, vocal fry valley girl kind of like, oh my God. Like, but that's not it. She has this, like, those piercing eyes and this big smile and the way she just, like, hits the jokes of the delivery. It's like you're at a roast and she is the host.
Yeah, she's very funny and, Yeah, she's great. But I did notice that storyline just felt a little like, oh, like it's, 2015. It's,
So we're going to talk about emojis now.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, so this whole episode is, like you said, Jake and Amy are investigating this Wendt guy, this highfalutin guy that they're trying to convince Captain Holt is a bad dude. And they're getting in trouble. They're running afoul of all of the, higher ups, the city hall.
Because he's got friends in powerful places and he is going to his friends in powerful places and being like, hey, these cops are investigating me. Gross. Make them stop. And the commissioner of police is like, I'm going to make it stop. So they convince Captain Holt to go with them to do some more investigating. So they go to the community center and they're kind of like staking it out, sort of watching what's going on. And all of these people go in and they've gotten a tip that there is a double set of books and that these duffel bags of drug money are getting dropped as charitable donations. And that's what they're using to launder money, right? So they're using this community center center as a front to launder drug money. So they need to get in the building and they need to get upstairs so that they can take pictures of these books to show that these charitable donations are coming in when their informant is saying that they are. So they get dressed up. We get like a
community
it's
event.
It's a ballroom dance competition. So then they're like, they go and we get the montage of them trying on the clothes.
The lead into that is like, Jake goes like, well, you know, there's only one solution for this. And Amy's like, don't say thrift store. And he's thrift store.
And so we get the montage of the different clothes and then they come out and they're being silly. And then,
well, this was one of my favorite lines where you have the music playing and Jake is doing the dancing and stuff. And then, you know, it's that joke that they do sometimes in movies where it's non-diegetic music that only us, the audience, is hearing. So they have the music cut out so you just see what's actually happening.
Right, and
in
the slow motion stops.
Right. So it's just Jake dancing like an idiot and Captain Holt is just standing there. He goes, Jake, the overwhelming time pressure.
Right. And then they run out.
And so they're back to the urgency of the situation. And yeah, the next 5 minutes or so of the show is going to be the three of them, you know, undercover, quote unquote, wearing these silly outfits they got at the thrift store at this ballroom dancing thing. And this is where you get the great Andre Brower faux serious humor, where they're all trying to, you know, infiltrate the situation and see what's what and figure out what to do. And whenever they have to talk to Andre Brower, he's like in the middle of some wild dance move. He's like got some lady that he's found to be his partner. He's holding her leg up like 180 degrees from the ground while he's telling Holt, like, focus, Jake, look for the money.
Yes, exactly. But he knows how to dance. And that was a surprise to everyone. And so they're trying to figure out how to get past the security guard that's guarding the door that goes to the upstairs. And so then Amy fakes an ankle injury and the security guy runs over to help. And then Jake gets upstairs and takes pictures of the books and they've got the evidence. And then as they're walking into the hearing for his suspension, because, you know, Jake's still being investigated.
Yeah.
And then Andre Brower's character stops Jake right before he goes into the hearing. He tells Amy to go on. And he's like, I need you to get fired.
Yeah,
he says, we have this evidence.
Yeah, he says, you have to trust me. It's a little bit like the old thing of, okay, here's the plan. First, we're going to we the audience don't get to hear it, or Jake to a certain extent doesn't get to know what he's doing this for. But he basically says,
you
take
have to
a
trust
dive,
me. Yeah.
Throw the hearing, let yourself get fired.
And not just get suspended, you need to get yourself fired.
Right.
And so he does it, he gets himself fired, he's sitting out in this parking garage after the hearing by himself with all of his insignia off of his uniform because he's been fired. And Amy comes out and she's like, what happened? Why? Like, what's going on? And she tells him, you know, captain told me to get fired. I don't know why. I'm freaking out. And then the captain walks over with these plain clothes, like FBI guys. And we find out that the captain has realized that there are moles within the precinct and within the department at large, and the commissioner he can't trust, but he shared the information that they had gleaned from their investigation, the fake books or the books that they had taken pictures of, with the FBI. And the FBI was like, he needs to go undercover. He needs to get fired. And now it's setting up this whole storyline that's going to happen in season two, which I don't know anything about. So tell us what is going on.
Yeah, well, basically the first handful of episodes of season two, at least, I don't remember it being like the whole season or anything, is going to be, Jake being, you know, fired from the NYPD, or so everybody thinks, and getting in good with this Iannucci crime family.
So he's undercover as like,
yes, that's
in the
scene.
Crime family working for the FBI now?
Right. So like you said, the FBI approaches him at the end and says, we need you to go undercover. So that was the scene we talked about at the very beginning of the episode, where he walks into the bar and says very loudly and conspicuously, you know, beer's on me, everybody. We're celebrating because my name is Jake Peralta and I've been fired from the NYPD. And so he's letting everybody know. And so we get that same scene again, now in its linear place and time, played at the very end of the episode. But we get the extra little moment of the guy next to him going, hey, nice to meet you. I'm Leo Iannucci. And so, yeah, this is setting up the second season is going to be the story of Jake ingratiating aligning himself with these mobsters, and it's going to be a fun, you know, sort of overarching plot for us. And so, yeah, you know, the other thing we didn't mention, of course, is Jake sort of puts his feelings on the line for Amy.
Sure. This is another one of these moments that we have in every sitcom now, right? That has, there has to be a will they, won't they? Yeah. So all through season one, there's been some tension between the two of them. Are they partners? Is that a normal thing?
I don't think the way that Brooklyn Nine-Nine presents it, they don't have regular partners. It's not like Dragnet where you're always in pairs. They tend to pair them up in different situations, you know, for the different episodes. But what I would say is, yeah, they're very much a will they, won't they. But I think they're a good example of this. They're a lot like Jim and Pam in the sense that, like, they don't have a lot of crazy operatic ups and downs. They're,
you mean they don't, he doesn't go and get a blue French horn stealing from a restaurant and like profess his love in the rain?
They have the obstacles of initially of being very different people. Like you said, they're a little, or like I said, like I explained, their personalities are a little bit of an opposites attract thing. And then there's just the issue of circumstance that they're dating other people. You know, during this time, Amy is with Teddy, who is this ubiquitous character actor who always plays this sort of, sometimes he's more of a nice guy, sometimes he's more of an asshole, but he's always like, they never bring him in to be like a guy who you're on his side. Andy Samberg is dating Eva Longoria for a while in the second season. So
that is not realistic.
Yeah. So they have obstacles like that. But for the most part, you know, they're people who work together and respect each other and come to like each other. And so, you know, after the circumstances kind of get out of their way over the course of the first couple seasons, they get together.
And, oh, they do.
Oh, yeah, they definitely do. So by the end of the show.
So in this episode, he is saying to her as he's just done a big, you know, goodbye at the precinct. So there are a few of the people that hold trusts that he's let them know.
Yeah, it's all the people whose names we see in the credits. Right. The idea is like there's the precinct at large.
But Chelsea and Peretti know.
Yeah, and probably not Hitchcock and Scully. That's true.
Yeah.
There's the whole precinct. It's just like The Office. There's all these people milling around, and then there's like this core group of characters.
So he lets, like, Holt calls Amy and a couple of the other police officers in and tells them, you know, here's what's going on with Jake. And then he's like, all right, Jake, have at it. Act like you got fired. And so Jake's like, and your mother, and your mother. And then he's like kicking trash cans and hollering and yelling.
We should
at
also
people.
Mention in his earlier tirade, now he has. Now he gets to do a faux tirade where he tells off Holt and his colleagues.
Right.
First, he got to do the faux tirade where he yelled at the police commissioner to get fired.
You can't handle the me.
Yeah, great line. You can't handle the me. And they love to do those little mini montages where they'll just like cut between a bunch of wacky things that he said. But yeah, so this time he's told everybody off and, you know, everybody thinks he's been fired. And so he gets this quiet moment with Amy in the parking lot where he basically says, I kind of like you. I kind of wish you weren't dating this other guy, you know?
Yeah. And that's basically how he says it. Like, I kind of wish we could do romantic-y stuff, but it's okay. I don't know if I'm going to die now because I'm going to go be undercover for a while. So bye. And like, that's the end of that.
It's very plainly stated, but I like it. Again, I think they're taking a page from The Office that, like, why not have the show be good and have interesting stories and let the romance just kind of brew naturally? You know, you don't need to devote a ton of screen time to it, at least not, you know, not all the time. And yeah, that almost makes it more authentic by just having it be this thing that, like, oh, by the way, I know there's all this crazy stuff going on in our lives, but, you know, I actually kind of like you. It makes more sense to me than, like, a lot of the crazy stuff that happens when you make the whole show about the romance.
Right.
You know? But yeah, again, look, and we didn't even mention the Boyle-Gina thing.
Right.
You know, Joe Latrullo's character has been broken up with, so he's walking around eating raw eggs.
Well, dressed not raw like eggs, Neo, hard-boiled eggs.
Dressed
a
like
sack
Neo
of
from
raw.
The Matrix.
Raw. I'm sorry, a sack of hard-boiled eggs. Yeah, you said raw. I can't stop saying raw. Gross.
It's only worth noting because it ends just like the Maxine and Kyle thing did from Single Ladies or from the single. The
Living Single.
Living Single.
Single Lady.
Beyonce presents. Single Ladies, the TV show. Yeah, it's the same thing where the very, very last shot of the season is a reveal of the two of them waking up post-coital in bed, cut to credits.
Yes. You know? Well, and they scream, ah! Yeah. Right? For sure. So that's it. That's a wrap on season one for us.
Yeah. Any overarching thoughts or favorites or anything about these four?
It was a really great episode, I think, to end on for the season one, because we purposefully picked all these shows that we hadn't gotten to watch yet for the podcast. But what it really is making me think about is, like, what are my takeaways? Like, what am I taking away from this season? And I think it's, I want to go watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine front to back. Never watched it. Was so excited. I was also introduced to Black-ish this year. Black-ish and Grown-ish, even though we didn't watch Grown-ish for the podcast. And The Goldbergs. These are the shows. Like, there, I now have four shows that I want to add into my, like, sitcom repertoire. And that is my takeaway.
I agree with all that. I jotted down a few sort of overarching takeaways also from the 52 weeks of watching sitcoms that we've done. One of my hypotheses is what you sort of just said, that the newer shows are a pleasant surprise to me. They tend to be better than I thought they would be. I wrote down basically everything from Big Bang Theory on. You know, I tend to think of those shows as the shows I saw advertised on subways and bus stops and stuff when I was in my 30s and just didn't have time for, and was just like, God, they're still making sitcoms? Who even watches those? And now, you know, like I said about How I Met Your Mother, there is this thing of, like, television in general was really kind of going through a renaissance at that time. And so all of my misgivings about Big Bang Theory are true. It's a Chuck Lorre show. It's kind of dumb, but also it's pretty funny. And yeah, Black-ish was really good. The Middle was one I had never seen before and I thought was really funny. So yeah, those newer shows are definitely, especially that sort of, like, not new, but that, like, you know, like early 2000s.
Yeah, 2010s time. Where there was just sort of a lot of stuff out there, but maybe we didn't see it all.
Right. And by contrast, the older shows are sometimes not as fun as I thought they would be. I'm looking at you, Munsters. That show, just that Fred Gwynne performance annoys the hell out of me. I think that production style I keep talking about, of just, like, shooting all around town and adding these lame laugh tracks to them, like, going back to the good old shows is great, but I think the notion of, like, oh, it'll be fun to watch these cheesy shows from the early 60s, now I'm kind of like, is it though? So, like, I think that was one of my takeaways, was that, you know, the nostalgia stuff is great, but yeah, the newer stuff is, you know, is more fun than I thought it would be.
Yeah, and I think some of the classic shows, though, really hit the mark, like The Honeymooners, I Love Lucy, the ones that still have the legacy to this day.
Yeah.
I think those have been a joy to kind of go to and see what was going on.
Yeah. And of course, the other thing that has become very apparent as we go through all of these shows over the years is, until relatively recently, you have not all, but the vast majority of sitcoms are locked into that white male point of view, right? And so that's been, you know, for better or worse, that has been the sort of fuel behind a lot of our conversations, breaking down what these shows have to say and what they're getting about it and why we like them or don't like them. I've just noticed that as something that comes up again and again. I think about, like, the example I wrote, which isn't even something that we've covered, but, like, that Tim the Toolman Taylor or Ray Romano persona that always gets under your skin, that dopey guy that needs to learn these lessons over and over again, right? Because he's just such a big dummy, and the woman just has to, like, stand there, and her whole role is to, like, constantly be the voice of reason.
So roll her eyes and put up with it.
Right. And then in the 21st century, we got Dennis Duffy in 30 Rock, right? You remember that guy who's played by Dean Winter, who now he's Mayhem in the insurance commercials.
Allstate commercials.
Yeah. Right. And I was just thinking about him. It struck me like he is that same character. But the difference is that show is from Tina Fey's point of view. So it's completely different. So you see him for like the total, you know, just idiot that he is, and not necessarily idiot like in a fun way.
I mean, he is that same character, but he's also a criminal. So there's that.
Yeah. But to me, that's just one of a million examples of the way like things get shaken up in the new century when you finally have some different voices authoring.
Yeah, it highlights the importance of having those different voices and why that, you know, so many of the sitcoms that were like, oh man, I really liked that, I can't believe I didn't watch that in the first place, are ones that were like, oh yeah, there's stories that have been not told in big places. You know, they haven't been on network TV.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess just the final thing for me, the single best surprise of doing the podcast is Perfect Strangers. That's the one that I really turned my nose up. I say it every time we cover it. I really, as a kid, even, you know, and it says something for a 10-year-old kid to say this is not sophisticated enough for me. But I really was just like, this is dumb. This, you know, the guy with the stupid voice, the other guy with the stupid hair. I was just like, I don't want to see this. And all throughout my adulthood, I look back at that as like, that is sitcoms jumping the shark writ large. That horrible voice that the guy does is borderline offensive and everything. And now when I watch it, I'm like, this is everything a sitcom should be. That simple vaudevillian style sort of approach where you get the slapstick crazy humor, you get the broad character arcs, right? You get that simple, you know, he's got to learn the same lesson all over again because he's such a big dummy and he just, you know, he's just totally lacking in self-awareness. It just knows exactly the right tone. And that Christmas episode where they have to like make the best of their Christmas, like we were on the floor crying.
Yeah,
like, it's it was so really good.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I did watch that show and liked it in its day, but it has been really nice because I also liked a lot of not so great shows in their day. Going back to Family Matters hasn't been as fun as I thought it would be. It's still fun, but it hasn't been as fun as I thought it would be. Going back to Perfect Strangers is a joy every time, as much as Larry is that character that drives me crazy, that has to keep learning the same lesson. And he's so maddening. It's so maddening, but it's fun. Like, I really enjoy it. Yeah. And I think it's because you have Balky as the foil and not a put upon woman who we're supposed to think about in a different way.
That's just what I was going to say, is we always get glimpses of this girlfriend of his, but so far in the ones we've watched, she's kind of a non-entity. Like, they're with them in that camping episode all the way, but they're always just kind of there rolling their eyes. And so, yeah, like, we could never really do a will they, won't they, or a relationship-y type thing with them because it's like a comic strip, you know? They're just silly.
Although it seems like we have a couple will they, won't they's that might be a future, you know, deep dive. Just in this episode, we've got Jake and Amy and Robin and Ted. So we'll next season maybe get into a little bit more of my angst and anger at Bayes and Thomas for their decision-making.
And by all means, let us know what shows you want us to cover that we haven't yet. And
we'll see you next year.
Yeah.
But not next year.
We will be back with new shows in a few weeks. And until then, we will consider this segment of the sitcom study concluded. Thank you for listening to The Sitcom Study. Tell us what you think or share your own TV tropes and topic ideas by sending a self-addressed stamped email to sitcomstudypodcast@gmail.com or find us on Facebook or Instagram. And if you like the show, consider leaving a rating or review on your podcast app. It helps us boost those precious Nielsen ratings. The Sitcom Study is recorded in front of a live studio dog.